and she beat me mercilessly, then repositioned the fatal pieces to show how I could have escaped a threat. There were suddenly about 57 ways to walk across an empty space, as if I were a cat with twitching ears entering an unknown lane. She spoke constantly as we played, either to distract me or to say something crucial about focus, her role model being a famous chess victory of 1858 that was given the title Opera, since it had actually been played in a private box overlooking a performance of Bellini's Norma. It was music my mother loved, and the American chess player, an opera enthusiast himself, had glanced now and then at the action on stage while playing against a French count and a German duke, who continually and loudly discussed their moves against him. The point my mother was making was about distraction. Priests were being bribed and murdered on stage, and central characters would eventually be burned on a pyre. And all the while, the American chess and opera enthusiast remained focused on the strategic path he'd chosen, undeterred by the glorious music. It was my mother's example of peerless focus. One night, a thunderstorm perched at the top of our valley, as we sat poised across from each other at a table in the greenhouse. There was a sodium lamp near us. My mother set up pawns and castles at their starting gates as the storm gradually rolled over us. The lightning and thunder made us feel defenseless within the thin glass shell. Outside, it could have been Bellini's opera. Inside, there was the drugged air of plants, and two bars of electrical heat attempting to warm the room. We moved our pieces in the faint, constant yellow of the sodium lamp. I was playing her well, in spite of the distractions. My mother, in her blue cardigan, smoked, barely looking at me. All that August, there had been storms, and then in the morning, clear, fresh daylight, as if a new century.
"Focus,"
she'd whisper as we sat down within the storm's gunfire and flare lights to another of our small contests of will. In a quarter second of lightning, I saw her fall briefly into the wrong trench of the battle. I saw the obvious move I had been left, but then another that was wrong, or that might be even better. I played it right away, and she saw what I had done. The noise was all round us, but now we both simply listened to it. A flood of lightning lit the greenhouse, and I saw her face, her expression of, what, surprise? A sort of joy. So finally, a mother and a son. If you grow up with uncertainty, you deal with people only on a daily basis. To be even safer, on an hourly basis. You do not concern yourself with what you must or should remember about them. You are on your own. So it took me a long time to rely on the past and reconstruct how to interpret it. There was no consistency in how I recalled behavior. I had spent most of my youth balancing, keeping afloat, until in my late teens, Rose Williams sat in a greenhouse and in the artificial heat of it played vicious competitive chess with her son, the only one of her two children who agreed to stay with her. Sometimes she wore a dressing gown that revealed her frail neck. Sometimes her blue cardigan. She'd lower her face into it so I could see just her distrusting eyes, tawny hair. "Defense is attack," said more than once. "The first thing a good military leader knows is the art of retreating. It's important how you get in and then how you get out undamaged. Hercules was a great warrior, but he died violently at home in a coat of poison because of his earlier heroism. It's an old story. The safety of your two bishops, for instance, even if you sacrifice your queen." "No, don't!" "Well, You played that. So this is what I do. An opponent will punish you for little mistakes. This will checkmate you in 3 moves. And before she moved her knight, she leaned forward and tousled my hair. I could not remember the last time my mother had touched me. I was never sure whether she was going to teach me or brutalize me during those tournaments. At times, she looked insecure, a woman from an earlier decade, mortal. It felt like a stage set. Something about those nights allowed me to focus on just her across our table in the semi-darkness, even if I knew she was the distraction. I saw how quick her hands were, how her eyes were interested only in what I was thinking. It seemed to both of us there was no one else in the world. At the end of that game, before retiring, though I knew she would be up a few more hours on her own, she set up the chessboard again. "This is the first game I memorized, Nathaniel. This is the game in the opera house I told you about." She stood over the board and played both hands, one hand white, one hand black. Once or twice she waited to let me suggest a move. "No, this," she'd say, not with irritation at my choice, but with wonder at the master's move. "You see, he went here with the bishop." She kept moving her hands faster and faster until all of the blacks were overcome. It had taken me a while to realize that I would in some way have to love my mother in order to understand who she now was and what she had really been. This was difficult. I noticed, for instance, that she did not like leaving me alone in the house. She avoided going out if I decided to remain indoors, as if she suspected me of wishing to rummage through whatever of hers was private. This was my mother. I mentioned this to her once, and she was so embarrassed, I pulled back and apologized before she needed to defend herself. I would later discover she was someone adept in the theater of war, but I felt the response was not a performance. The only time she revealed something of herself was to show me a few pictures that her parents had kept in a brown envelope in their bedroom. There was the serious schoolgirl face of my 17-year-old mother under our lime tree bower, as well as photographs of her with her strong-willed mother and a tall man, sometimes with a parrot on his shoulder. He had a recognizable presence and reappeared in a handful of later pictures with my mother, slightly older, and her parents at the Casanova Review Bar in Vienna. I was able to read the name on the large ashtray on the table, next to the dozen or so empty wine glasses. But otherwise, there was nothing at White Paints that gave away anything about her adult life. If I were Telemachus, I would find no proof of her activities as that disappeared parent. No evidence of those journeys of hers on wine-dark seas. Most of the time we puttered about, staying out of each other's way. I was relieved to go off to work each morning, even on Saturdays. Then one evening, after one of our light suppers, I became conscious of my mother's restlessness, and that she was clearly eager to get out of the house, even with the possibility of oncoming rain. Grey clouds had been above us all day. "Come, will you walk with me?" I didn't want to, and I could have pushed it, but I decided to go along and was greeted with an actual smile. "I'll tell you more about that game at the opera," she said. "Bring a coat. It will rain. We don't want that to turn us back." She locked the door and we headed west onto one of the hills. How old was she around that time? Perhaps 40? I was now 18. She had married young, the habit and fashion of the time, though she had studied languages at university, and once told me she had wished to take a law degree, but gave that up and instead raised 2 children. She was in her early 30s, so still youthful, when war started, and she began working as a signals operative. Now she was striding beside me in her yellow slicker. Paul Morphy was his name. It was October 21, 1858. Okay, Paul Morphy, I said, as if ready for the second serve she was about to send over the net. Okay, she half laughed. And I will only tell you this once. He was born in New Orleans, a prodigy. At 12 he beat a Hungarian grandmaster who was traveling across Louisiana. The parents wanted him to become a lawyer, but he gave that up and followed the game. And the greatest match in his life was the one played in the Italian Opera House in Paris, against the Duke of Brunswick and Count Isoire, who are remembered for only one reason, that they were beaten by this 21-year-old. I was smiling to myself. All these titles. I still remembered Agnes naming one of the dogs who had eaten her dinner in Mill Hill the Earl of Sandwich. But it was also the situation and location where the game was played that made them all famous, as if it were a scene in an Austro-Hungarian novel or an adventure like Scaramouche. The three players were sitting in the Duke of Brunswick's private box, practically above the stage. They could have leaned down and kissed the prima donna. And it was the opening night of Bellini's Norma, or The Infanticide. Morphy had never seen Norma, and was eager to witness the performance, for he simply loved music. He was sitting with his back to the stage, so he'd play quickly, then turn back to the footlights. Perhaps that's what made it a masterpiece, each move being a fast sketch in the sky, barely touching the reality of Earth. His opponents would debate among themselves and make a tentative move. Morphy would turn, glance at the board, push forward a pawn or a knight, and return to the opera. His clock time during the whole game was probably less than a minute. It was inspired. It is still inspired. Still considered one of the remarkable games. He was playing white. So the game begins with the Philidor defense, a passive opening for black. Morphy is not interested in taking black pieces in the early stages, preferring to mass his forces for a quick checkmate so he can get back to the opera. Meanwhile, the theoretical discussions by his opponents grow louder and louder, irritating the audience and the lead singer, Madame Rosina Penko, who is playing the High Priestess Norma, and keeps flinging her stare towards the Duke's box. Morphy brings out his queen and the bishop, working together to dominate the center of the board, forcing black into a tight defensive position. My mother turned in the darkness and looked at me. Are you following the game on the board? I am following it, I said. Black is very soon in shambles. Now it is intermission. Everything has been occurring on stage. Romantic love, jealousy, a wish to murder, notable arias. Norma has been abandoned and decides to kill her children. And all the while, the audience has been watching the Duke of Brunswick's box. In Act Two, the plot continues. The black pieces are idle, pinned to their king. The knights frozen by Morphy's bishops. Are you following? Yes, yes. Morphy now brings a rook into the attack down the center of the board. He makes a series of sensational sacrifices in order to squeeze black into an increasingly hopeless position. And he follows with the stylish queen sacrifice I showed you the other night that will quickly lead to mate. By the time the climax of the opera occurs, when the consul and Norma decide to die together in a funeral pyre, Morphy can give all his attention to the music, leaving his opponents in ruins. Wow. I say. Please don't say wow. You were only in America a few months. It's an expressive word. Beginning with that Philidor defense, it was as if Morphy had invented a great philosophical profundity on his way to the opera. That happens, of course, when you are not looking at yourself too carefully. And it happened that night. It is almost 100 years later, and that little move in the shadows, across the footlights from Norma, is still recognized as genius. What happened to him? He retired from chess and became a lawyer, but was no good at it, so he lived off the family money till he died, in his 40s. Never played chess again, but he had his moment, with exceptional music. We looked at each other. We were both soaked. I had been conscious of the rain at first, then forgotten it. We stood by the entrance to a copse, and far below us was our lit white-painted house. I sensed that she was happier here than she would ever be in that secure warmth. Here, where we were no longer housebound, there was an energy and lightness in her I rarely saw. We walked under the cold darkness of the trees. She had no wish to turn back, and we were there for some time, barely talking, private. This is how she must have appeared to others she worked with, I thought, during her silent wars, in the midst of those unknown contests. My mother has heard from Mr. Malachite that a stranger has moved into a house a few miles from White Paint and has been uncommunicative as to where he is from, as well as what his profession is. She hikes alongside Rumberg Wood, passes the moat farms southwest of the village of St. James, until she is in visual distance of the man's house. It's early evening. She waits until all the lights go out. Then another hour. Finally, she returns home through the darkness. The next day, she appears again a quarter of a mile away and watches the similar lack of activity. Until the gaunt man emerges in the late afternoon. She follows him cautiously. He circles the perimeter of the old aerodrome. He is going nowhere, really. She can tell that. He's just on a ramble. But she stays with him until he returns home. Once more she waits in the same field, past the hour when nearly all of his lights are out. She makes her way closer to the house, changes her mind, and turns for home, again torchless in the dark. She has a tentative chat the next day with the postman.
Do you talk with him when you deliver the mail?
Not really. He's a scarce one. Doesn't even come to the door.
What kind of mail does he get? Does he get a lot?
Well, I'm not allowed to say.
Really?
She almost laughs at him. Well, books often. Once or twice a package from the Caribbean.
What else?
Apart from books, I'm not sure.
Does he have a dog?
No.
Interesting.
Do you? He asks.
No.
The conversation has not been of much use to her, and she ends the chat, which the postman by now seems eager to pursue. Later, with official help, she is able to discover what exactly is being delivered to the stranger, along with what he is mailing out. As well as the fact that he comes from the Caribbean, where his grandparents were indentured servants at a sugar plantation in the British colony there. It turns out he is some sort of writer, apparently quite well known, even in other parts of the world. She learns to pronounce and repeat the stranger's name to herself, as if it is a rare imported flower.
When he comes, he will be like an Englishman.
Rose had written this in one of her spare journals I found after her death, as if even in the privacy of her home, even in a secret notebook, she needed to be careful with the revelation of a possibility. She may even have muttered it mantra-like to herself.
When he comes, he will be like an Englishman.
The past,
my mother knew more than anyone, never remains in the past. So in the privacy of that notebook, in her home, in her own country, she knew she was still a target. She must have assumed that would be the disguise a person bent on vengeance would have to adopt, in order to enter the depths of Suffolk and reach her without suspicion. The only clue to a motive would be that he would probably come from a zone of Europe where she had once worked, and where questionable decisions of war had been made. "Who do you think is going to come for you someday?" I would have asked her if I had known. "What did you do that was so terrible?" And she would, I think, have said, "My sins are various." She admitted to me once that my shadowy father had been better than anyone at building levees and firewalls against the past. "Where is he now?" I asked. "Asia, perhaps?" The answer evasive. "He was a damaged man. We went our separate ways." She swept her hand horizontally as if wiping a table clean. My father, who had not been seen by us since that long-ago evening when he boarded the Avro Tudor. A changeling discovers his own bloodline, so I was never to know him as well as I knew the darter or the moth. It was as if the two of them were in a book I was reading in my father's absence, and they would be the ones I learned from. I desired unstoppable adventures with them, or even a romance with a girl in a cafeteria who might fade from my life unless I acted, insisted. Because that was what fate was. For a few days I tried breaking into other archives, in the hope of discovering some presence of my father. But there was no evidence of him in any capacity, at home or abroad. Either there was no record of him there, or his identity was more deeply classified. For this was a place where altitude took over, the higher echelons of the 7-story building disappearing into a mist that had long ago cut its ties with the everyday world. A part of me wished to believe that here was where my father still existed, if anywhere. Not in some far reach of the empire, monitoring the Japanese military surrender, and going loco from heat, insects, the general complexity of post-war life in Asia. Perhaps all that was a blind fiction, like that promotion of his in the Far East, as opposed to what I wanted to imagine him doing, nearer to home. The evasive, smoke-like man, never referred to, not even, it seemed, existing in print. For remembering how my father had, a few times, let me accompany him to his office in the city before his departure, showing me the large map where his various business dealings existed, the coastal harbors and discreetly hidden island empires. I wondered if such offices had also served as intelligence centers during the war. Where was that office building in which my father explained how his company imported tea and rubber from the colonies, and where a lit map revealed a bird's-eye view of the economic and political terrain of his universe? It may have been this very place, for all I knew, or some other location that had once housed similar covert activities. What role did my father really have in the office he took me to when I was a boy? Because in such establishments, I have discovered, that the height of the floor means power. And that building reminds me now of nothing so much as the Criterion, where some of us worked in the basement laundries and steam-filled kitchens, never allowed to enter the higher reaches of the building, instead winnowed like fish at the gates and ladders, so no one got higher than banquet halls, and then only by putting on the disguise of a servile uniform. Had I already been in one of those cloud-hidden office heights with my father in my youth? Once, almost as a joke or a quiz, I wrote a list of possible fates of our father and sent it to Rachel. Strangled in Johor. Strangled on board a ship on his way to the Sudan.
permanently AWOL. Permanently undercover, but active. In retirement at a facility in Wimbledon, paranoia invading him, constantly irritated by sounds coming from a nearby animal hospital. Still on the top floor of the Unilever building. I never heard back from her. So many unlabeled splinters in my memory. In my grandparents' bedroom, I had been shown formal pictures of my mother as a student, but there was not one of my father. Even after her death, when I scurried around white paint to discover whatever clues I could find of her life and death, I came across no photographic evidence of him. All I knew was that the political maps of his era were vast and coastal, and I would never know if he was close to us, or had disappeared into one of those distances forever. A person who, as the line went, would live in many places and die everywhere. A nightingale floor. There was no coverage of my mother's death in the newspapers. The death of Rose Williams caused little public response in the larger world she had once belonged in. Her small obituary identified her only as the daughter of an admiral, and did not mention a location for her funeral. There was, unfortunately, mention of her death in the Mint Light. Rachel was not at her funeral. I tried reaching her when I was given the news, but there was no reply to my telegram. Still, there were a surprising number of people from out of town who attended. People I assumed my mother had worked with in earlier days. This in spite of the secrecy of the location. She was buried not in the village near to us, but some 15 miles away in a parish of Benacre in the Waveney district. It was there her funeral took place. My mother was not religious, but she had loved the simple bearing of that church. Whoever had organized the service must have known that. It was an afternoon funeral. The chosen time allowed those who had come from London to catch the 9 a.m. train from Liverpool Street and return afterwards on the late afternoon train back to the city. Who, I wondered, as I looked at the group gathered around the grave, had planned all this? Who had chosen the line for her gravestone? I have travelled through perils and darkness, not unlike a champion. When I asked the Malachites, they claimed they did not know, though Mrs. Malachite thought it had all been done efficiently and tastefully. There were no journalists among the gathered, and those who came by car had the vehicles wait a few hundred yards from the graveyard's entrance, so no attention was drawn towards them. I must have appeared distant in my grief for my mother. I had been given the news at college just the previous day, and the anonymous mourners no doubt regarded the 18-year-old boy by the grave as parentless and adrift. One of them did, at the end, come over and wordlessly shake my hand, as if this were adequate consolation, before continuing his slow, thoughtful walk out of the graveyard. I spoke to no one. Another gentleman approached me and said, "Your mother was a remarkable woman." And I did not even look up. In retrospect, it was rude. But he had come to me as I was looking into the grave, at her narrow coffin in the fit of the earth. I was thinking the coffin maker, and whoever had ordered it, must have known how especially thin Rose Williams was, and known how she would have liked the black cherry wood, known that the chosen words of the service would not have appalled her or been ironic to her, and might have even chosen the line by Blake for the gravestone. So I was looking at what was 3 or 4 feet below me, and thinking of all that when I heard the man's quiet, almost shy voice speak. "Your mother was a remarkable woman." And by the time I came to an awareness of courtesy, the tall man, whom I had not acknowledged, but who had respected whatever privacy I was in, had moved away, and I saw him only from behind. After a while, the churchyard was empty, save for me and the Malachites. The Londoners and the few village people who had come to pay their respects were gone. The Malachites were waiting for me. I had not seen them since the news of her death. I'd only spoken with Sam on the telephone. I approached, and then he did this thing. He opened his large, moist badger coat wide. His hands were in its pockets, and enclosed me within it, next to his warm body, next to his heart. He was someone who'd barely touched me in all the time I had known him. He seldom inquired how I was doing, though I knew he was curious about what I might become, as if I were still green in judgment. I stayed the night at their house, the window of the spare bedroom looking down onto their walled garden. And the next day he drove me to Whitepaint. I'd wanted to walk, but he said he needed to speak with me. That was when he told me how she died. No one else in the village knew what had happened. He had not even told his wife. My mother had died in the early evening, and Mr. Malachite found her about noon the next day. It was clear she had died instantly. He carried Rose Williams. He called her by her full name, as if suddenly there was no intimacy between them anymore, into the living room. Then he dialed the telephone number that she once had given him, as he was supposed to do if and when anything happened to her, even before he called me. The voice at the other end of the line asked for his name and to identify where he was. It asked him to confirm once more that she was dead. He was told to wait. There was then a pause. The voice returned and said he should do nothing, just leave the premises. That he was to be silent about what had happened, and also about what he had just done. Sam Malachite reached into his pocket and passed me the original note she had given him 2 years earlier, with the number he was to call. It was informal but carefully written, without emotion, though I felt I could read in its clarity and exactness an unvoiced sentiment, even fear. He dropped me off at the rise that looked down towards our house. "You can walk from here," he said. Then I went towards my mother's home. I entered her stillness. I put some food outside for the feral cat, and I banged a saucepan before entering the kitchen, as she used to ward off the infamous rat. Someone had been there, of course. There was not a mark on the sofa where Mr. Malachite had laid her down. Anything that might have provided a clue had been taken away. I guessed there would be a prompt and efficient investigation of her death, and that if there was any retaliation by the government, it was sure to be invisible. I would not be notified. And there would be nothing in the house they did not want found. Unless she had left something casually, for me to pick up and place beside some conversational grain of sand she might have once mentioned. "Mr. Malachite reminds me of a friend of mine, though Mr. Malachite's is more innocent," she had said. Only the word was not innocent, it was benign. Which was it? It was benign, I think. Somehow it mattered. There's a distinction. For a while I did nothing. I circled the garden, and almost as if it was coincidence, I could hear the call of a cuckoo moving round the house, formally singing. When we were small, our mother used to say, "A cuckoo from the east means comfort, from the west, luck, from the north, sadness, from the south, death." I searched for it, following the sound for a while. Then entered the greenhouse, where she was supposed to have died. Whatever greenhouse panes had been shattered were now fixed. I kept recalling how I was seldom allowed to be alone in the house, and how she would always be eyeing me to see what I picked up or was interested in. Now that I was released from her watchful gaze, the rooms felt more potent. It grew dark outside. I pulled a few German paperbacks from the shelf to see if she had written her name in them, but she always had a printless foot. There was a book about Casanova in his later years, by a writer named Schnitzler. I took it upstairs with me and got into bed. It must have been about 8 in the evening when I did this, and I fell quickly into the strange, compressed story of Casanova's attempt to return to Venice in middle age, all of its action taking place over a period of a few days, and fitting within the small canvas of a novella. I focused on the unexpected and convincing compassion towards Casanova. It was in German, and I was lost to time. As the story ended with Casanova's sleep, I slept too, the bedside light on, the small book still in my hands. I awoke in the bed I always slept in, turned off the bedside light, and found myself in the darkness of 3 in the morning, wide awake. I felt I needed to walk through the house with a different mindset, the more European gaze of Schnitzler. Besides, it was now the hour when my mother was always awake. I moved slowly through each room with the torch, opening cupboards, dresser drawers. I searched my bedroom first of all. It had been hers when a schoolgirl, though nothing of that time was evident on the walls. Then her parents' bedroom, frozen in their own era, left as it was since their death in the car accident. Then the third mid-sized room, which belonged to her, with its narrow bed, like her coffin. There was a Regency walnut desk inherited from her mother, where she often sat in the middle of the night, erasing as opposed to recording her past. It was where the barely used telephone in the house was. Mr. Malachite would have needed to come into this room to ring the number she had given him. Perhaps in London, perhaps somewhere else. In that walnut desk, I did find, wrapped in one of my mother's crumpled shirts, a framed picture of Rachel I had never seen before. As I studied it, it became clear it must have been taken during the period when my mother was away from us, supposedly unaware of our activities. I wondered who had taken it. The moth. How conscious of us had our mother been when we were unconscious of her? The stranger aspect of the picture was that Rachel appeared to be dressed more like an adult, with an adult's demeanor, than the teenager she was at the time. I had never seen her dressed like that. By the end of my night search, I'd found nothing new, not even something forgotten on a top shelf of the cupboard in my bedroom. She had obviously scoured through it before suggesting I use it when I first came to stay during my holidays. All I had was the carefully framed and hidden picture of my sister, whom I realized I had not seen for over a year. It was about 5 in the morning now, and fully awake, I decided to go downstairs. I walked down the stairs into a cold silence, and as I stepped onto the wooden floor at the foot of the stairs, the nightingales began in the dark. The suddenly loud squeaks would have woken anyone, as they had my mother a year earlier, when I had come downstairs in the middle of the night. I'd simply been hungry then for some cheese and milk, and as I turned back, captured within that chaotic noise, there was her figure already at the top of the stairs with something, I'm not sure what, in her hand. When she saw me, she put it behind her back. Wherever I kept stepping for the next few moments, with her watching me, relieved but slightly scornful, the sounds kept revealing where I was in the semi-darkness. There was only one narrow edge of the floor a person could walk along to have silence. But now I was alone, and simply walked down the hallway within the noise, until I entered her small carpeted living room with its fireplace, and the nightingale alarm stopped. I sat down. My mind leapt strangely, not to what my sister and I might have lost with Rose's death, but to her earlier departure from us, when it felt we had lost so much more. I thought of her pleasure in renaming us. It had been my father who insisted on my being called Nathaniel, but that was too long a word for my mother. So I had been Stitch to her, just as Rachel became Wren. Where on earth is the Wren? Even with adult friends, my mother enjoyed searching out better names than the ones they had been baptized with. She had plundered names from landscapes, called people by place names of where they'd been born, or even where she first met them. "There's Chiswick," she'd say about a woman she overheard on the radio, picking up a local accent. Such fragments of curiosity and information were always being shared with us when we were young. And she had taken all of that when she disappeared, waving goodbye. I thought of that erasing of herself, just as now, alone for the first time at White Paint. I realized I'd lost her living voice, all the quick-witted intelligence she owned when young, all the secret life she'd stepped into and kept from us, now lost. She had reduced the house to a skeletal path. Her bedroom, the kitchen, the small living room that housed a fireplace, and the short passageway of books that led to the greenhouse. These were the locations of her life in the last years. A home once filled with country neighbors and grandchildren had been cut down to the bone. So during the 2 days I stayed after the funeral, I saw more evidence of her parents than of her. I did come upon a few sheets of handwritten paper in a cupboard. One contained an odd meditation on her indoor rat, as if it was a never-leaving guest she had in time become used to. There was a drawing to scale, probably by Mr. Malachite, of her garden. A constantly redrawn map of the country surrounding the Black Sea. But most of the cupboards were empty, as if someone had removed the essential evidence of her life. I stood in front of her bookcase, modest for a person who lived alone in the country and who barely listened to the radio unless Mr. Malachite mentioned a storm warning. She must have been tired by then of other voices, save those she discovered in novels, where a plot might swerve wildly and then somehow turn easily for home during the last 2 or 3 chapters. There were no ticking clocks in this stripped-down, silent house. The telephone in her bedroom never rang. The only evident, and therefore surprising, source of noise was the nightingale floor. It comforted her, she told me. Gave her safety. Otherwise, silence. During my holidays, I could hear her give out a sigh or close a book in the next room. How often did she return to the shelves of paperbacks, where she could be with Balzac's Rastignac, and Félicie Cardot, and Vautrin? "Where is Vautrin now?" she once inquired of me drowsily, coming out of a sleep, perhaps unaware whom she was speaking to. Arthur Conan Doyle claimed he never read Balzac, not knowing where to begin, that it was too difficult to locate the sources or first appearance of any of the central characters. But my mother knew all of La Comédie Humaine, and I began wondering in which of the books she might have found a version of her own unrecorded life. Whose career did she trace, scattered within those novels, until she could understand herself more clearly? She would have known that Le Bal de Sceaux is the one book in La Comédie Humaine in which Rastignac does not appear, but also that within it he is being constantly referred to. On a whim, I pulled a copy of it from the shelf, flipped through, and inside,
tucked between pages 122 and 123, found a hand-drawn map of what looked to me like a chalk hill on 6x8 quarto-sized paper, with no place names on it, a fragment that probably meant nothing. I went back upstairs again and opened that old brown envelope of photographs still in my grandparents' room. But there were fewer of them now. There weren't the more playful, innocent ones she had shown me during an earlier summer. I saw again my mother's serious young face under the lime bower that led from the kitchen. But later photographs, the ones I had loved best, were no longer there. So perhaps they had not been innocent. The ones of Rose with her parents and the tall man familiar from the other photographs. One, especially of them all, in the foreign decor of the Casanova Review Bar in Vienna, with my mother in her late teens, sitting in a haze of cigarette smoke in the midst of this adult entourage, an ardent violinist bending towards her. And even a few other pictures, as if in time-lapse, taken maybe an hour later. All of them in the back of a taxi, crushed together and laughing. That was my father's friend. He was our neighbor. His family were Thatchers. Rose had told me when she showed me the photographs that were no longer there. I had pointed to the extra man and asked who he was. He was the boy who fell from the roof. What was his name? I don't remember. But now, of course, I knew who he was. He'd been the one at my mother's funeral, with the shy, quiet voice, who stood beside her grave and attempted to speak to me. He was older, but I recognized him from those scattered photos, where he had the same height and presence. I'd once or twice seen him in the hallways of our building, a legend in the office, waiting to take one of the restricted blue lifts to a high, unknown floor, up to a landscape only imagined by most of us working there. My last night at White Paint, two nights after the funeral, I went to my mother's room, got into her narrow, sheetless bed, and lay there in the dark, the way she must have done, looking up at the ceiling. "Tell me about him," I said.
"Who?"
"The person you lied to me about. The man whose name you said you couldn't remember. The man who spoke to me at your funeral." The boy on the roof. He would look down from that sloped straw roof whenever one of Rose's family emerged from the house to collect eggs or get into the car. The 16-year-old Marsh Felon had entered my mother's childhood as a teenager because the roof of White Paint needed rethatching. He and his father and his two brothers had roosted up there through the early summer, sometimes sunstroked, sometimes buffeted by great winds, the clan of them working with efficiency, always in conversation, with never a doubt among them, myth-like in unison. Marsh was the youngest, a listener. During the winter he cut and stacked reeds, solitary in the nearby marshes, so they would be dry by spring when his brothers pierced and weaved them into the long-stemmed straw on the roof, with pliant willow branches that they bent like hairpins. The sudden gale had lifted Marsh and flung him off the roof, and he fell grabbing at branches of the lime bower, attempting to slow his fall before he landed 20 feet down on the paving stones. The others came down out of the loud wind and carried him horizontally into the back kitchen. Rose's mother made up the daybed. He needed to remain immobile and not be moved. So Marsh Felon would become a resident for a while in this back kitchen of strangers. The L-shaped room was lit only by natural light,
There was a wood stove, a map of the region of the saints, depicting every footpath and river crossing. It would become his world for the weeks his brothers continued working on the roof. He heard them as they left at sunset, and he woke to their loud, persistent conversations as they climbed their ladders the next morning. After the first few minutes, their talk was not quite audible. He heard only the laughter and yells of irritation. 2 hours later, he became aware of the family moving in the house, their conversations hushed. The world felt close, yet distant to him. It was the way he felt, even when working on the roof. Sensing the great, active world far away was passing him by. The 8-year-old girl brought him breakfast and left quickly. She was often his only visitor. She would just stand in the doorway. He could see the further reaches of the house behind her. Her name was Rose. His own family had been motherless and womanless for years. Once she brought him a book from the family library. He consumed it and asked for another.
"What's this?"
She had noticed a few sketches on the last blank page of a book she had given him to read.
"Oh, sorry."
Marsh felt mortified. He'd forgotten his sketch.
"Don't mind. What is it?"
"A fly."
"Odd fly? Where'd you see it?"
"No, I make them. Flies for fishing. I can make you one."
"How? From what?"
"Maybe a blue-winged olive nymph. I'll need thread, waterproof paint."
"I can get that."
She almost left. "No, there's more." He asked her for paper, something to write on. "I'll make a small list." She watched.
"What's this say? You got awful handwriting. Just tell me."
"All right. Small goose feathers. Red copper wire, not much thicker than human hair. They use it on small transformers."
"Slow down."
"Or dynamos. Perhaps you could bring me a needle? Also some silver foil to let it shine." The list continued. Cork, pieces of ash. Some of what he asked for he had never used before. Could she bring him a small notebook? He was only imagining possibilities, as if he were in an unvisited library. She asked for details of the thread, the size of the hooks. She noted even then that unlike his handwriting, the sketches were meticulous. They seemed made by a different person. The youth felt this was his first conversation in years. The next day he heard the motor car leaving the driveway, the girl with her mother. Most of the day he sat by the sunlit window, his fingers constructing the fly, echoing his drawing but for the colours, or stood awkwardly in front of their map and searched it for what he already knew and what he had not known before. The clear line of oaks along the straight Roman roads, the long curve of the river. At night he slid from the bed into the darkness and tried to move his ungainly body. It was important he couldn't see himself. If the hip gave way, he fell against a wall or the bed. He moved as long as he could, then got back into the bed, covered in sweat. All this was unknown to his family or the girl's family. During their last week of work, the brothers slipped themselves into their rope halters and leaned over the roof, using the blade of the long flue knife or the long Eve's knife to trim the gable ends. Looking up through the window, the boy could see just the iron blade sweep back and forth, the remnants of straw falling like barley. Then the family carried him, once more horizontal, back onto their cart, and disappeared. The silence that had been lost filled the house again. Now and then in the following months, the girl and her parents would hear of the felons working on a house in a distant village, as if crows had found a new copse to nest in. But the youngest son, Marsh, whenever he was allowed free time, attempted to overcome his limp. He'd wake in the dark and walk past houses they had once thatched, or go down into the river valleys as night began dissolving, already with birdsong. It was the hour with that tense new light that Marsh Fellon now began searching for in books, whenever the writer strayed from a plot to attempt a description of that special hour, perhaps remembered from the author's youth too. The boy began reading every evening. It allowed him a deafness while his brothers talked. Even if he knew the thatcher's craft, he was separating himself from them. Plenitude. What does that mean exactly? A surfeit of things. Replenishment. A complete state. A wished-for thing. The person named Marsh Fellon wished to study and inhale the world around him. When Rose's family rediscovered him 2 years later, a young man, they barely recognized him at first. He was still watchful, but he had become another, already serious, curious about the workings of the wider world. Her parents gathered him in, as they had once done during the injured solitude of his youth. Aware of his intelligence, they were to support him through his university years. He had essentially left his own family. Fellon nested himself against brick cornices, then climbed up the college tower in the dark, more than 150 feet above the unseen landscape of the quadrangle. 3 nights a week he tested himself along the rain-slicked tiles until the hour or two before light, when buildings and lawns began to display themselves. He had never considered the public tests of rowing or rugby. Just his scarred fingers and quick movements revealed his strength. In a second-hand bookstore, he had found an anarchic work, The Roof Climber's Guide to Trinity, and assumed at first its obsessions were a fiction, a childhood adventure. So he had begun to climb as if to search out its truthfulness, or perhaps a meticulous raven's nest in a belfry. He saw no one else there on those nights, until one evening he came across 2 names scratched with a nail beside the year 1912. He strolled the cloister roofs, ascended rough walls. He felt ghost-like, even to himself. He started seeing other nocturnals. It turned out to be a climbing tradition based on that privately printed book Marsh had discovered by Winthrop Young, a rock climber before his Cambridge days, who, missing such adventures, turned what he called the sparsely populated and largely anonymous buildings into his college Alps. The Roof Climber's Guide to Trinity, with maze-like illustrations and meticulous descriptions of the best climbing routes, had, during the 2 previous decades, inspired generations of stegophilists who ascended drainpipes along the beehive route and slithered across the insecurity of tiles cresting the Babbage Lecture Theatre. So there would be other climbers, yards away, alongside Fellon. He stilled when he saw them, slid past with no acknowledgement. Just once, in a windstorm, his hand reached out and gripped a coat as a body fell past him, and he pulled the person into his arms, the shocked face staring through the buffeting wind at him, an unrecognized first-year student. Fellon left him there on a safe ledge and climbed higher. In December, descending a chapel tower, Fellon passed a woman who touched his arm, refusing to let him pass without a greeting.
"Hello, I'm Ruth Howard, Mathematics, Girton College."
"Marsh Fellon," he found himself saying. "Languages." She continued,
"You must be the one who caught my brother. You're the secretive. I've noticed you up here before."
He could barely see her face. "What else are you studying?" he said. His voice felt loud to him in the dark.
"Mostly the Balkans. It's still a mess."